Chapter 33. 3 kilometers later, the Rolls-Royce pulled off to the side of the road. Its 2 rear tires were flat. During the traffic stop, Hermann and Anna had each shoved a specially milled screw into the tire on their side. The screws had a hollow shaft and a hole in the head to let the air out. Once the Rolls-Royce had fallen behind, they pulled off on a side road, put a hood over Malevsky's head, better secured him with duct tape, and placed him in the trunk. When they got back to the barn, Harvath was ready for them. Eichel sat naked, bound to the chair he had been bound to previously, surrounded by the plastic sheeting. The only windows in the barn had been covered over with black garbage bags. Eichel was illuminated by 4 pairs of 1,000-watt tripod-mounted work lights. Despite their blinding white light, they did little to warm the drafty old structure. Equal measures of fear, exhaustion, and cold were causing Eichel to tremble. That was what Harvath wanted. Anna had driven the police vehicle back inside the barn so that it couldn't be seen from outside or overhead. She wanted to stay, but it was going to get ugly. Malevsky would be harder to break than Eichel. It wasn't the kind of thing Anna needed to see. Her assistance in the traffic stop had been invaluable. She had done a perfect job. Right now, though, the best thing she could do was return to Frankfurt. Harvath would take things from here. They said their goodbyes inside the barn. Walking her out to her car would only have been asking for trouble. He liked her, and that bothered him. It bothered him because she was married. And not only was she married, but her husband was critically ill. It wasn't right. It also bothered him because he felt disloyal to Lara. Their situation was in flux, but it wasn't necessarily over. He shook his head at that thought. Not necessarily over. What else could it be? She had chosen her career, and he had chosen his. It meant 2 different cities, Boston and D.C. Could it work? Anything was possible. Would it work? That was the real question. If your career was the central force in your life, the thing that defined you, how much time were you going to allocate to a long-distance relationship, regardless of how much you love that other person? Supposedly, love conquered all, but would it counter countless security checkpoints, delayed flights, and all that time spent in travel? Being in a relationship that was geographically undesirable didn't seem to make much sense. It would be one thing if it were temporary, a holding pattern while the parties figured out how to end up in the same city. But Harvath and Lara had already been through that. In fact, they had been transitioning out of it. Now, they had been dragged back into it. There was a lot to be said for having the person you loved close. Being able to walk into the kitchen and just see their face, spending a Sunday morning doing nothing but reading the paper together, a Saturday night watching an old movie in front of the fire. People needed what they needed, and they usually needed it when they needed it. Getting together every other weekend, if they were lucky, plus vacations, wasn't a relationship. At least, it wasn't the kind he was looking for. Harvath loved Lara. He didn't, though, love the idea of loving her from a distance. As a couple, they were moving backward. "She has good instincts," said Hermann. Harvath had been standing at the barn door watching Anna leave. His friend's voice brought his attention back. "With the right training, she'd probably make a halfway decent operative," Hermann continued. "She's being wasted at the Bundespolizei." There was a lot of promise in Anna Strobel. On multiple levels, but Harvath didn't want to think about that. Not right now. He needed to focus on Malevsky. Drawing Hermann out of earshot of their captives, he explained how he intended things to go. Once everything was set, they pulled Malevsky from the trunk of the police car. Harvath nodded, and Hermann pulled the hood from the Russian mobster's head. Malevsky blinked several times, trying to get his eyes adjusted. He looked from side to side. He saw the other prisoner, naked and restrained to a chair. He was shivering and had a hood over his head. Malevsky was nonplussed and stared daggers at his captors. Harvath walked over and tore the duct tape off his mouth in one quick rip. As soon as he did, Malevsky started cursing him in Russian. Harvath waited for him to finish. But Malevsky didn't finish. He was only just getting started. Harvath spoke some Russian, but not as much as he would have liked. He could pick up a few foul words here and there. The rest he just guessed at via the mobster's tone. When he couldn't get a rise out of Harvath in Russian, he switched to German. Here, Harvath was a little stronger linguistically, but not by much. Hermann, though, found the man's threats amusing and chuckled at some of the more creative ones. Harvath drew back his fist and punched Malevsky in the mouth as hard as he could. There was a spray of blood, and the force from the blow knocked the Russian over backward in his chair. His head cracked against the floor. Harvath let him lie there while he found a towel and wiped off his hand. He was setting the tone. He wanted Malevsky to know that he could keep this up as long as he wanted. He was in no hurry. The man grunted something that he couldn't make out.
"English, please," said Harvath.
"Fuck your mother."
Harvath smiled. It would be a real battle of wills with this guy. He was a street thug. All he understood was brute force. He would talk. It just came down to how much suffering he was willing to endure before he did.
"You're a dead man,"
Malevsky added.
"Dead."
He drew the word out, as if that would make it more frightening. He had no idea who he was talking to. That was about to change. Harvath perused a line of tools he had sitting on a long table. He stopped at the ball-peen hammer Hermann had purchased and picked it up. It had a bright yellow handle and a black rubber grip. He tested its weight.
"Left or right knee?"
he asked.
"Fuck your mother!"
Malevsky spat. Harvath turned the hammer sideways and ran it along the outside of the Russian's left leg. When he found his knee, he bounced the hammer against it a couple of times. Malevsky wound up to issue another "fuck your mother," but Harvath was faster. With lightning speed, he swung the hammer and shattered the man's knee. The Russian screamed at the top of his lungs. Tears flooded from his eyes and down his face. Harvath returned the hammer to the table and said,
"Tell me about Sasha Basayev."
Malevsky let loose with another string of curses in Russian. Harvath indicated for Hermann to tip the mobster back upright in his chair. When he was sitting up, Harvath repeated the question.
"You are a dead man,"
Malevsky replied.
"Dead man."
"Have you ever been to Iraq, Mr. Malevsky?"
said Harvath, looking over his tools.
"Fuck you!"
Harvath paused. Then he smiled and went back to selecting his next tool.
"Many years ago, a Russian diplomat was kidnapped. The Iraqi government tried for a week but couldn't locate him. The Russian embassy brought in a team of specialists, men I would imagine like you. They quickly figured out who one of the kidnappers was and went to his house. Of course, the kidnapper wasn't there, but his family was. They grabbed one of the men, it was his brother, I believe, and then they drove off. An hour later, the Iraqi family heard a knock on the door. When they opened it, there was a small box sitting there. Inside, they found the brother's ear. One piece of the brother, his nose, a finger, his lips, the other ear, was delivered every hour until the Russian diplomat was released. The Russians had been able to do in one day what the Iraqis couldn't do in an entire week. Harvath stopped at a straight razor and picked it up from the table. "How many of your body parts would it take for your family to cooperate?"
A flash of panic rippled across Malevsky's face. It had only been there for a fraction of a second before he got it under control and masked it. But the micro-expression, the tell, had manifested itself nevertheless. That gave Harvath an idea. Chapter 34. Harvath had been against using Malevsky's kids if at all possible. It wasn't their fault they had a shitbag for a father. They were innocents. And as much as Harvath bent and often broke the rules, there were still some lines he was against crossing. If there was any way to leave the Malevsky children out of this, he wanted to. But there wasn't. In fact, it was Malevsky himself who had opened the door to their inclusion. The man was like a block of Russian granite. Harvath could chip off piece after piece, but it was going to take a long time for him to break. There was also the risk that Malevsky might go into shock or even die. Things happened. Kumaran was a perfect example. Murphy of Murphy's Law had a funny way of popping up when you least expected him. Malevsky was in a trap he had built for himself. The pain and agony it would cause him was only just beginning. Harvath didn't have any reservations about chipping away at him all day long, if that's what it took. The man had information he needed. Malevsky had been facilitating an assassin who had taken American lives. Harvath wanted that assassin, and Malevsky was going to tell him everything he knew. By using his children, Harvath hoped to get to the end point a lot faster.
"You have two lovely daughters, Mr. Malevsky. They look to me about 5 and 7 years old," said Harvath. "Am I close?"
The tell once again flashed across the Russian's face.
"If you touch my family," he hissed, "I will kill you. Do you understand me? I will kill you, motherfucker!"
Harvath ignored his threat.
"Who is Sasha Basayev?" "I am going to watch you die. Then I'm going to find the people you care about, and I'm going to watch them die."
Harvath backhanded him hard and repeated,
"Sasha Basayev, who is he?"
Malevsky spat a gob of blood on the ground.
"I have no idea who you're talking about."
Harvath gestured to Hermann, who walked over and removed the hood from Eichel.
"So what?"
said the Russian, unfazed. Harvath cracked him again, even harder.
"Eichel told us everything. Now it's your turn."
Malevsky looked up at Harvath, blood running from his nose and mouth, staining the front of his shirt, and smiled through gritted teeth. Harvath drew back his hand to strike him again, but stopped. Instead, he stepped away, cleaned his hands with the towel, and removed his phone.
"Do your children have any pets, Mr. Malevsky?"
he asked. The Russian refused to answer. Harvath sent a quick text message and then leaned back against the table as he waited for a response. When his phone chimed, he looked down and read the message out loud.
"Your older daughter is allergic to cats, but they have 2 goldfish.
The smug smile on Malevsky's face barely wavered.
"With enough money, you can find out anything. Cats, fish. I could even tell you what color underwear your wife is wearing."
Harvath smiled back at him and sent another text. Minutes passed. Finally, his phone chimed once more. Harvath read the text and opened the attachment. Turning the phone around, he showed it to Malevsky. It was a photo of his 2 daughters. They were holding up pictures they had drawn. One was of a yellow hammer. The other was of a barn. The smile immediately disappeared from the Russian's face.
"Satisfied?" asked Harvath. "Or would you like to know what color underwear your wife is wearing right now?"
You're the American who toured my house. What have you done with my family?"
"All that matters is what I am going to do. Anything that happens to them will be because of you. If you cooperate, we'll let them go."
"Who is we? America?"
Harvath cupped his hand and struck Malevsky in the left ear. It made a loud pop, and the mobster cried out in pain.
"I ask the questions, not you. You give answers. Anything else, and I will instruct my colleagues to go to work on your family. Is that clear?"
Malevsky nodded.
"I can't hear you." "Yes,"
the Russian relented.
"Clear."
"Good," said Harvath. "Now, who is Sasha Basayev?"
Chapter 35. Washington, D.C. Next to the attack during his childhood, swimming through the cave system had been one of the most terrifying things Sasha Basayev had ever experienced. He never wanted to do anything like it again. Flooding from the rainwater had been a serious problem. Multiple areas that should have contained pockets of breathable air had been completely submerged. In one area, where they had been able to surface, his guide had discussed turning back. The young man was afraid that they wouldn't make it. Quietly, Basayev made plans to kill him and take his diving cylinders. There were guidelines and line markers to point the way. He could have made it without him, unless something went wrong. The doubt gnawed at him, and so he pushed the young man to see the journey through. The young Mexican was extremely reluctant, but he must have seen something about Basayev. He must have seen that his own life hung by a very tenuous thread at that moment. Wisely, he chose to press on. When they emerged on the U.S. side of the border, a smuggler was waiting for them. He had protein bars, bottles of water, and a fresh change of clothes for Basayev. Even though he had been wearing a dry suit, he was drenched, having sweated through what he had on beneath. He washed himself in the cold cave water, put on the new clothes, and followed the smuggler out to his battered Ford F-150 pickup. Everything he owned at that moment was in a small, sealable bag he had carried inside the suit. He had cash, credit cards, false identification, and a smartphone with spare SIM cards. The smuggler drove Basayev into the nearest town, Laredo, Texas, and dropped him at the bus station on Salinas Avenue. From there, Basayev was on his own. With plenty of stores within walking distance, he was able to purchase everything he needed. Once his shopping was complete, he hailed a cab and headed out to the airport. A Cessna Citation M2 business jet was waiting for him when he arrived. After shaking hands with the captain, he climbed aboard and stowed his bag. The interior was tight, but the caramel-colored leather seats were wide enough and could be folded flat. All he cared about was sleep. As soon as the jet lifted off, he closed his eyes. Within minutes, he was asleep. When he awoke, the jet was on final approach to Manassas Regional Airport in Virginia. He had slept the entire trip. He cleaned himself up in the restroom of the FBO and then had a cup of coffee while he waited for his Uber vehicle to arrive. The explosion of apps like Uber and Airbnb had been a godsend in his line of work. No matter what hat he wore, assassin, terrorist, spy, he didn't need a complicated support network of safe houses, cars, and dead drops. And many of the things he did need, especially in America, were only a click away. The credit cards and bank accounts he used wound through false holding companies and addresses around the globe that were empty or simply didn't exist. Trying to track him based on his financial activity was useless. The GRU had created a maze of blind alleys and dead ends. And considering what Basayev was about to undertake, they fully expected the Americans to pick every single transaction apart. But by then, it would be too late. The damage would already be done. The distance from Manassas Airport to downtown Washington, D.C. was only 30 miles, but it took almost 2 hours in traffic. Basayev had the Uber driver drop him at the Marriott Marquis on Massachusetts Avenue. It was adjacent to the convention center, where he said he was attending a conference for human resource managers. In the lobby, he found a bellman and checked his bag in their temporary luggage storage. He then exited the hotel through another entrance. Somehow he had thought Washington, D.C., the seat of American power, would feel different. He had expected to be awed. He wasn't. Turning right, he walked down New York Avenue. One thing he was struck by was how many cameras there were. Cameras were excellent for solving crimes, not necessarily for preventing them. With that said, software had gotten to the point where computers could tell if a bag had been left unattended, or could be directed to find things like a man on a yellow bicycle. Computers were not going to stop what he had planned. At 15th Street, New York Avenue ended, and Basayev stepped onto Pennsylvania Avenue. Instantly, he could feel an electricity course through his body. The defenses, the countermeasures, the things most normal people would never notice, were all around him now. The lengths to which the Americans had gone was ridiculous. All this to protect one man, one building? But that man and that building were both symbolic, facts not lost upon Basayev. When he had drawn even with it, he had to stop and look. The awe was there now. The White House and all it represented was staring right back at him through its wrought iron fence. It was dramatic. A tourist standing nearby asked him to take her family's photo. He declined politely and began walking again. 4 blocks later, he removed his phone and checked his GPS. Looking up, he saw the building he was headed for. Not too close and not too far. It was just right. By the time the United States figured out what it had been used for, he would be long gone. Chapter 36. Berlin, Germany. Mikhail Malevsky had identified his handler as Viktor Sergun. Whether or not that was Russian for big fucking headache, Harbath wasn't sure, but that's exactly what the man was. Colonel Viktor Sergun was Russia's military attaché to Germany, based out of the Russian embassy in Berlin. Malevsky had also confirmed that Sergun was also Sasha Basayev's handler. The GRU routinely placed operatives as military attachés in order to garner them protected diplomatic status. If they were caught engaged in espionage, the worst a host country could do was to kick them out. Sergun, though, had been involved in much more than espionage. He had been involved in terrorism, including the murder of the U.S. Secretary of Defense and his protective detail. In Harbath's book, that voided him, just as it had Malevsky, of any protections whatsoever. The call, though, wasn't his to make. It had to come from D.C. Going after Sergun meant raising the stakes again, dramatically. The Russians could consider it an act of war. While they could have attempted the same argument over Malevsky, it would never stick. Not when the Germans had an investigation going into his organized crime practices, and the U.S. had enough to paint him as a mobster as well. Sergun, though, was another matter. Harvath had worked his way up the chain to get to Sergun. All he had to implicate the colonel, though, was the coerced confession of Malevsky, the aforementioned mobster. Russia could deny everything and paint Malevsky as a criminal who had gotten caught and would say anything to make a deal. It would be a mistake for any of it to be made public, and the United States didn't intend to. Harvath had been tasked to work outside the system, any system, and that's what he would continue to do. Once the word came back from D.C., Harvath set his own wheels in motion. They would have to move fast. If Sergun didn't know Malevsky had gone missing, he soon would. After cleaning up the barn, they ditched the state police vehicle and anonymously tipped Bavarian law enforcement on where they could find their officers. Then Harvath and Hermann drove their own cars to Berlin. Harvath spent the entire 6-plus-hour drive on his phone, engaged in encrypted conversations with the United States. He'd been away from any source of news and had no idea that ISIS had released a video of the Secretary of Defense being attacked. Pulling off into a rest area, he and Hermann watched it together. Feelings of guilt washed over him anew. It was all connected. Somehow, he was a factor in the equation. He was certain of it. Beyond pissed off, he got back in his car and got back on the Autobahn. For a while, he couldn't talk to anyone. Hearing that the secretary and his detail had been assassinated was tough enough. Seeing it was gut-wrenching. He let himself marinate in his anger for a while longer, and then forced his mind to get refocused on what he needed to do. It wasn't easy. The anger ate away at him like acid. Getting back on the phone, he tried to let the demands of figuring out a strategy divert his attention. Slowly, a plan began to come together. But even as it did, there were elements too sensitive to be discussed, even via encrypted communications. Those would have to wait until he arrived in Berlin and could speak with the CIA station chief directly. One of the other issues Harvath had to figure out was what to do with Eichel and Malevsky, both of whom were making the trip in the trunk of Hermann's BMW. They couldn't be released, yet hanging on to them was not only a security risk, but also a major pain in the ass. As he neared Berlin and saw signs for the airport, a possibility took root in his mind. A lot would have to happen between where he was now and what he was thinking about. Looking in his rearview mirror, he saw Hermann flash his high beams. Harvath moved over to let him pass. Hermann had been on his phone for a good chunk of the drive, too. He didn't want to keep the prisoners at his home in Berlin. That was a no-go. He promised Harvath he'd find them another location, and he had. Harvath followed him off the motorway and into an old East Side neighborhood called Friedrichshain. When the wall went up in 1961, the boundary between the U.S. and Soviet sectors had run right along its edge. In World War II, Friedrichshain had been one of the most heavily bombed areas of the city as the Allies targeted its factories. Now, it was a funky neighborhood filled with young people and artists. There were cafes, pubs, and clubs, mobile phone stores, bank branches, and apartment buildings. For all its gentrification, it still had pockets of derelict and abandoned buildings. It was one of those buildings that Hermann had been able to secure. With bars over the windows and its walls covered with graffiti, the building appeared to have once housed a produce distributor. As soon as Hermann pulled into its loading area, there was the sound of a winch being engaged and the rolling steel service door beginning to rise. Inside were four rough-looking men dressed in black combat boots, jeans, and the black nylon flight jackets popular with the skinhead crowd. These men weren't skinheads, though. They had tight military-style haircuts and wore black tactical watches. If Harvath had to lay odds, his guess would be that they were former commandos just like Hermann. He followed the big BMW inside and parked next to it. Getting out, he joined his friend. Hermann shook hands with the men and then introduced Harvath. Their names were Adler, Kluge, Bosch, and Farber. They had been members of Hermann's old counterterrorism unit and now worked for his private security company. With the assignment growing more dangerous and complex, Hermann thought it would be a good idea to have a few more hands on deck. Three of the men, Adler, Kluge, and Bosch, would have fit in anywhere in Europe or the United States. Farber, though, stuck out. He had dark skin, dark hair, and very dark eyes. He looked like he would have been right at home on the streets of Riyadh or Tehran.
"How's your Arabic?" Harvath asked.
"Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim," he replied.
"In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate." Harvath knew the phrase. Every chapter in the Quran except for the ninth began with it. "I bear witness that there is no God except Allah," he continued in Arabic, "and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah." Hermann looked at Harvath and smiled.
"Not bad, eh? German-Jewish father and Lebanese mother. They met in Hamburg."
Not bad at all. In fact, his Arabic was excellent, perfect for what Harvath had planned. As long as witnesses bought it, that was all that mattered. Whether or not the Russians would buy it was something else entirely. Harvath glanced at his watch. He was meeting the CIA's Berlin station chief at a bar. It was only a few kilometers from the embassy, and he wanted to get there first. There were a couple of things he and Hermann needed to go over, though, before he could leave. The man named Bosch gave them a quick tour of the building. There wasn't much to see. Two defunct walk-in coolers would be used to house the prisoners. They were virtually soundproof and could be locked from the outside. A system of tiny wireless cameras had been placed around the inside of the structure, as well as outside on the perimeter. They would be monitored around the clock. Two offices had been set up with cots and sleeping bags. The toilets worked, and there was even a shower, though no hot water. they'd have to rough it. Once the tour was complete, they established a procedure for communications. Then, Harvath left the building. Walking the streets of Berlin, he felt an uncomfortable sense of déjà vu. A lot of blood had been spilled here, by him and because of him. One of Hermann's people had even been killed. Harvath didn't like that the Russians had drawn him back. No matter how badly they were punished, they kept returning for more. Their expansionist desire to reconstitute the glory of the Soviet Union was as bad as the Islamists wanting to recreate their caliphate. It reminded Harvath how necessary it was to confront both. Without a counterbalance, he had no doubt the world would descend into darkness and chaos. But what was Russia's play now? What did Saleh, ISIS, Sacha Basayev, Sergun, and the others have to do with it? What was the endgame? Arriving at number 4 Mannsteinstrasse, Harvath hoped to get some answers. As he pushed open the door of the Leidecke pub and stepped inside, it was like walking back in time, right into the heart of the Cold War itself. Chapter 37. The E&M Leidecke had been owned and operated by the Leidecke family for more than 100 years. It was a traditional German pub, dark with heavy oak tables and lots of carved wood. Its most significant feature, though, was barely visible. Behind the bar was a beer stein. Its base was wrapped with a piece of barbed wire. The wire had been cut in the middle of the night from the Berlin Wall itself. The words "Für die Sicherheit" was inscribed upon it. For the security. It was the motto of an elite, highly classified American black ops unit that had been stationed in Berlin during the Cold War. The members posed as everyday Berliners. Across the city, they had hidden weapons, gold coins, explosives, and radio equipment. If the Russians had ever overrun the wall, it had been their job to launch guerrilla warfare. The Leidecke had been the team's unofficial headquarters. As part of his initiation, each operative was required to sneak up onto the wall using night vision goggles, snip a piece of barbed wire, and return without being caught by the Soviets. Each man then received his own numbered stein, with his piece of barbed wire wrapped around the base. Helfried Leidecke, the bar's owner, received his own special mug as a thank you for supporting the unit. As far as Harvath knew, there were still items buried in the basement and sealed up behind the plaster walls. The entire establishment was a living time capsule. When Harvath had last come to Berlin, it was to rescue one of the team members. Though years had passed and the unit had been shut down, it had been reactivated. In the process, a good friend of Harvath's, a man who had been like a second father to him, had been taken hostage. A complicated trail of clues had led him to number 4 Mannsteinstrasse and Helfried Leidecke, a short, balding man with wire-rimmed glasses, a gut that hung over his apron, and a wildly unkempt mustache. He had a reputation as a man not to be trifled with, and was extremely rough with patrons he believed were not drinking enough. On the first day Harvath had arrived, Leidecke had given him a tough time. He pretended to have no idea what Harvath was talking about or whom he was looking for. Everything changed, though, as soon as Harvath pointed out the stein and recounted its significance. Looking around now, he was disappointed. Leidecke was nowhere in sight. The pub was half full, mostly locals, taking up all the spots at the bar. Harvath found a small table tucked in the back. It had a halfway decent view of the front door, but, more important, would allow for a private conversation. Though it was what he wanted, he knew better than to order a cup of coffee. He asked for a beer and if Herr Leidecke was in. "Nein," his server replied, before heading off to get his drink. It was good to see that their customer service standards hadn't changed. Once the server returned with his beer, Harvath settled in to wait for the station chief to show up. Helen Cartland appeared 20 minutes before their appointed rendezvous. She walked in, removed the hat she had been wearing, and began to scan the pub. She was an attractive woman in her late 40s, with short brown hair and a hip sense of style. In boots and a moss-green hunting jacket, she came off as more British than American. Stopping at the crowded bar, Cartland ordered a glass of white wine and took her time. She had seen Harvath, but she wasn't in any hurry to approach. She was a professional. She wanted to get a good feel for the room and who was in it before she joined him. 5 minutes later, she picked up her glass and walked over.
"I'm sorry, but did we meet last year in Munich at Oktoberfest?" she asked.
Harvath studied her for a moment.
"I think we did. It was in the Kafer tent, wasn't it?"
Cartland nodded.
"May I join you?"
"Please,"
he replied, standing as she took the seat across from him. Once she was seated, he thanked her for coming.
"Washington didn't give me much choice. Would you like to tell me what's going on?"
"I'll tell you what I can," said Harvath.
"Why don't you start with who you are?"
"You can call me Phil."
Cartland paused, then replied, "Phil." She obviously didn't believe him. That didn't matter. She didn't need to know his real name. The less she knew, the better.
"Okay, Phil," she continued. "I assume you're a Green Badger of some sort?"
Green Badger was a term used to describe outsiders hired by the CIA. Harvath nodded.
"Corporate or independent contractor?" she asked.
"Does it make a difference?"
"It might help me understand the scope of this."
Harvath drained the last sip of his beer and held up the empty glass when the server went by.
"You want another?"
he asked, pointing at her wine. She shook her head. Harvath indicated to the server that only he needed a new drink, and then turned his attention back to the station chief. The CIA's Directorate of Intelligence and its National Clandestine Service were full of contractors. Many of them were even agency alums who had retired, only to return on special contracts that paid tons more.
"You looking to jump ship?"
"Me?"
she replied, her voice kicking up an octave.
"Just curious, that's all."
She was interested. That was dangerous. There was nothing wrong with someone thinking ahead career-wise. A station chief doing it openly with a stranger, though, was unsettling. Harvath shifted the conversation to the reason they were there.
"What can you tell me about Sargon?"
Cartland rattled off his dossier from memory.
"Divorced, well-educated, 58 years old, no children."
"Girlfriend?"
She shook her head.
"Boyfriend?"
"No romantic involvement in Berlin that we know of."
"How about an address?"
Cartland removed a package of cigarettes from her purse and placed them on the table.
"There's an SD card in there. It has the whole workup we did on him when he got posted here."
"Photographs?"
Harvath asked. She nodded.
"How does he get to work? Does he have a driver?"
"No," Cartland answered. "The Russians are notoriously cheap. Only the ambassador gets a full-time driver. Anyone else who needs a vehicle has to request a Volkswagen from the small pool they keep at the embassy."
"So does he walk, ride a bike, taxis?"
"He walks. His apartment isn't far from the embassy."
That was a piece of good news. Taking Sargon from a vehicle with or without a driver was something he didn't want to hassle with.
"Anything else?" Harvath inquired. "Hobbies? Does he like sports? Is he a drinker?"
Cartland laughed.
"What Russian isn't a drinker?"
She had a point.
"What I meant was," Harvath clarified, "is there anything we can use to our advantage? Does he have a place he frequents?"
"Pasternak."
"As in Boris Pasternak, the author?"
The station chief nodded.
"Restaurant Pasternak. It's named after him. They specialize in Russian food. A lot of the older Russian embassy employees go there for drinks and dinner on Friday. Normally, Sargon's with them."
"And after?"
"He zigzags back to his apartment."
"Meaning he's drunk?"
"He may have downed a couple, but he's still switched on. He runs a good SDR to make sure he isn't being followed. He's always on his guard, so be careful. Don't underestimate him."
"I won't,"
Harvath replied, his plan crystallizing in his mind.
"What can you tell me about the area around the restaurant?"
On a Friday night, it's busy. Real busy. Not a place to be if you're looking to stay under the radar. Going unnoticed around there is almost impossible. Good, Harvath thought, as the server returned with his beer. Going unnoticed was the very last thing he had in mind. As in Vienna, he wanted their act to be seen. The one thing that concerned him, though, was, could they afford to wait until tomorrow night? They needed to get to Sergun sooner rather than later. He was the key to tracking down Basayev. The longer they waited, the greater the chance that something might happen. Harvath glanced at his watch and did the math. They could make their attempt in the morning, but Sergun was a soldier. If he was the up and at his desk before anyone else type, they might not have the public audience they needed. The only thing that made sense was to grab him on the way home, either from the embassy, or better yet, from the restaurant. Harvath understood that he didn't have a wide latitude of choices. He just prayed that he wouldn't regret his decision. Chapter 38. Friday, Washington, D.C. Basayev had chosen Zainab because she was a woman. In addition to being young and attractive, she was also fast. Very fast. They had met in Syria. She had come to join the jihad and fight for ISIS and the caliphate. The recruiter she had made her way to was highly intelligent. He realized that sending a woman like Zainab to the front lines would be an unforgivable mistake. When Allah blessed you with such a gift, it was because he intended for it to be used appropriately. Zainab was placed in a house and protected, kept away from the other recruits until a decision could be made. The leadership, as it had been doing more and more, had consulted with Basayev. And as he had proven to them time and again, he did not disappoint when it came to strategy. Zainab possessed dual American-Kuwaiti citizenship. She was a student at Georgetown University who had returned to Kuwait on her American passport and then traveled on to Syria with her Kuwaiti passport. For all intents and purposes, her trail was clean. The Americans had no way of knowing that she had gone anywhere other than Kuwait to visit relatives. It was too good an opportunity to pass up. Basayev and several ISIS leaders spent considerable time interviewing her. They needed to be absolutely certain she was devoted to the cause. She had made it to Syria, determined to fight. But what would happen when she returned home to America? Would she lose her resolve? Would she change her mind? After much deliberation, it was decided that she was incredibly resolute and that she could be counted on to fulfill her mission. When her mission was decided upon and her training complete, she was sent back to the United States and told to wait. Now, here they were. Zainab only needed to make it 30 yards, from the fence to just beyond the fountain. Anything more than that was welcome, but under no circumstances, not even if the door was wide open, was she to cross the threshold and enter the White House. If she did, it would ruin everything. She needed to remain outside, in full view of the cameras. Basayev knew the Secret Service wouldn't shoot. They wouldn't turn their canine teams loose on her either. The White House was too politically sensitive. Images of a young female protester of Middle Eastern descent being shot or attacked by dogs on the White House lawn wouldn't play well on television. 30 yards. That's all he needed. She promised that she wouldn't fail him. Despite the bright sunshine, the crisp April day had never gotten out of the low 50s. Everyone was wearing a jacket, including Zainab. As she walked, she could make out the sweet, rose-like scent of the cherry blossoms beginning to peak around the tidal basin. It was a good omen. Allah had blessed this day. The banner she carried was a work of art. It was made of silk and would stream beautifully behind her as she ran across the grounds. All the eyes of the world would be upon her. It was the most incredible opportunity she had ever been given. She was excited and intensely nervous all at the same time. Only 30 yards, she reminded herself. Basayev had studied the Secret Service. He had watched all the videos and had read all the articles regarding breaches of White House security. and after he had analyzed them, he had shown them to Zainab. For her to be successful, she needed to know what she was up against and how to deal with it. They took tea together one last time. It was at the apartment he had arranged within walking distance of the White House. They talked for hours, stopping only to pray for Allah's protection and continued guidance. After giving her a pill to help her sleep, he made himself comfortable on the couch and waited out the rest of the night in case she changed her mind. She did not. The next morning, he rose early, shaving his dark stubble and changing into a fresh shirt he had purchased in Texas. When Zainab finally entered the kitchen, he smiled warmly and offered her a cup of coffee. The drug he had given her the night before had been strong. It took her a few minutes to clear away the cobwebs. He produced a small pill box and offered her a different item this time.
"Something the brothers and sisters in Iraq and Syria have found helpful," he said as he pushed the thick pill toward her. "It packs the courage of a lion and the strength of 10 men.
Zainab didn't argue. Accepting the drug, she placed it on her tongue and washed it down with a mouthful of coffee.
"Is there anything I need to do about the apartment?"
she asked after swallowing. She was moving her hand in a wiping motion.
"You mean clean it for fingerprints?" Basayev responded. "I'll take care of it. You focus on the greatness you are about to achieve."
They prayed together once more before he told her it was time to get ready. Because it was such a special day, there were certain additional rituals that needed to be performed, including how she was required to bathe. Once she was fully dressed, she stepped back into the living room so that Sasha could look at her one last time. Everything was perfect. She was perfect. She would not fail him. Of that, he was certain. They had grown close during their time together in Syria, and he was not afraid to make a show of his affection. Like a brother or a cousin, he placed one soft kiss upon her forehead as he pressed 2 more pills into her left hand.
"Take these just as you are about to leave."
They exchanged a few more words, and then he was gone. Sitting alone in the kitchen, she watched the clock on the microwave. It was almost surreal to have the knowledge of what was about to happen when no one else did. Exhilarated her. The drugs only enhanced her excitement, causing her to feel almost euphoric. When the appointed time arrived, she couldn't wait to get moving. Pouring a glass of water from the tap, she swallowed the pills Basayev had given her, zipped up her jacket, and left the apartment. She had been told not to alter her route unless she believed she was being followed. With nothing to give her that impression, she continued on.
"You will not see me," Basayev had told her, "but I will be close. I will be watching over you."
She stole occasional glances as she walked to the side and behind, hoping to catch one last glimpse of him. But true to his word, he was nowhere to be seen. The pills he had given her, though, had heightened her awareness. Even though she couldn't see him, she believed she could feel his presence. He was all around her. Zainab followed her route to Lafayette Square Park, just across the street from the White House. There, she saw the permanent array of protesters, each hoping to catch the attention of the president and the media. She was about to teach them how to do both. She didn't need to remind herself to smile. There was a radiance pouring out of her that she simply couldn't contain. She felt more alive, more certain of herself and her purpose in life than ever before. Chapter 39. Berlin, Germany. Viktor Sergun left his apartment building at 7 a.m. sharp, walked to the end of his block, and turned left. He was wearing a gray suit and a navy blue trench coat. His black shoes were polished and his hair neatly combed. A small piece of toilet paper marked where he had nicked himself shaving that morning. Harvath's instructions had been crystal clear. He didn't want Sergun followed. He only wanted confirmation. Once Sergun disappeared around the corner, Adler radioed Kluge. As soon as Kluge saw Sergun enter the embassy, he radioed Hermann. It was on. They numbered 6 men total. Two needed to stay back with the prisoners, which meant they were left with four operatives at any given time in the field. Surveilling an embassy was no easy task. Surveilling the Russian embassy specifically was an open invitation to get caught. For all their faults, the Russians weren't stupid. They weren't careless either. In addition to being heavily invested in electronic countermeasures, they spent a lot of time focused on good old-fashioned human tradecraft. The embassy lay just east of the Brandenburg Gate on a grand boulevard named Unter den Linden. It was one of the busiest, most popular areas in all of Berlin. In addition to being packed with shops, cafes, offices, and assorted tourist sites, there was a tree-lined allée replete with park benches that ran right down the middle of the boulevard, which offered multiple places where someone could position themselves to conduct surveillance. To combat this issue, the embassy sent out roving teams of observers. They were dispatched sporadically, which made them hard to spot. Hard, but not impossible. There was a look to them, something that said Eastern European. The casual observer might miss it, but not someone who knew what to look for. Hermann's men knew what to look for. As such, they had been able to rotate in and out of the area. One at a time, they kept an eye on the embassy, while avoiding detection by its CCTC cameras and observation teams. Around noon, Harvath and Hermann headed to the restaurant Pasternak. They took their time looking for a parking space, driving around the neighborhood in order to get a feel for it. There were multiple bottlenecks and choke points, but there were also multiple side streets and opportunities to disappear. It was a mixed bag, but Harvath and Hermann both agreed that net-net, it was too good a location to pass up. The restaurant sat on an odd-shaped corner where several streets met. A long outdoor terrace like that of a Parisian cafe wrapped around the front. Across the street, an old water tower that had been converted into apartments rose from a thick green park. They took a table under one of the red awnings outside and ordered lunch. Hermann had a beer. Harvath drank Red Bull. Watching the traffic pass, they quietly discussed what the neighborhood would look like tonight and what kind of problems they might encounter. When their meals came, they ate, and then each man used the restroom in order to scope out the restaurant from the inside. After walking all the way around the long block, they retrieved Hermann's BMW and drove back to the old produce warehouse in Friedrichshain. Farber and Bosch were finishing up their shift, keeping an eye on the prisoners. Harvath pulled up an overview of Berlin on Hermann's laptop and walked them through what he had seen. They discussed primary and alternate routes, as well as what should happen if police became involved, or if they were unable to get back to the warehouse. All of them knew that anything was possible. The key to success was being ready for anything. That included having a backup plan, in case Sergun didn't go to the restaurant. If that happened, they were going to have to take him at his apartment. All things considered, grabbing him at his apartment was a safer option, but it would not have the benefit of being a public spectacle. Harvath wanted witnesses because he wanted them to talk. If it looked like Sergun had been grabbed by a team of Arabic speakers, the Russians wouldn't know what to think, much less what to do. They might think it was a ruse, but they wouldn't be certain. It would keep them off balance, doubting. The second layer of the onion was Malevsky's driver and bodyguards down in Berchtesgaden. According to Malevsky, no one in his organization knew that he was doing work for Sergun and the GRU. Harvath found that highly unlikely. In fact, he knew it would only be a matter of time before word filtered back to Moscow that Malevsky had been apprehended. When that eventually happened, the Russians would be chasing their tails, wondering what Germany's involvement was and whether it stretched beyond Malevsky's money laundering activities. It only had to keep them tied up long enough for Harvath to get to Sergun. Once he had his hands on him, he didn't really care what the Russians knew. At that point, it would be game over for them. When he was finished, Farber floated several questions, along with a couple of suggestions. There were two security cameras Harvath had pointed out that he was concerned about. Since they would be wearing masks and taking other precautions, he wasn't worried about being ID'd. What he was concerned with was appearing too professional. They needed to come off as lucky, good, but not great. It couldn't look too polished or too choreographed. Not only would the German security services not believe it, neither would the Russians, once the CCTV footage was shared with them. There had to be a little sand in the gears, a mistake or two, rookie moves that no pros would engage in. From front to back, it had to feel like a jihadist production. Harvath agreed and was already three steps ahead of him. He laid out his ideas and then went back and forth with both Farber and Bosch. Finally, they came to a meeting of the minds. Some of the things that Harvath had suggested meant the operation would take longer than it should, but they would add legitimacy. The hardest part would be going against years of training. There were certain things that had been drilled into all of them, certain things that they didn't even consciously think about. They just instinctively knew to do them. Tonight, though, they were going to have to turn several of those things upside down. The big thing they had in their favor was that they had all spent countless hours dissecting tactical videos, both the good guys and the bad. They knew what the professionals would be looking for. That, they hoped, would give them the upper hand. As long as they all played their roles as scripted, it should come off exactly as they wanted it to. The last thing Harvath raised was footwear. It was a small detail, but an extremely important one. He didn't want any of them wearing tactical boots. Their big black watches had to stay behind as well. Anything that could even remotely tag them as pros was off limits. He didn't care what some terrorist had been caught wearing in the past. None of that stuff could be part of this operation. Farber and Bosch agreed. It wasn't worth it. The entire team had already ditched their distinct boots and jackets for more low-key street clothes anyway. They were well-trained and knew that their surveillance of the Russian embassy required them to blend in. With everything settled for the time being, Harvath got ready to take up his post when his phone rang. It was Lydia Ryan calling him from Langley.
"Hey," he said, answering the call.
"What's up?"
"Turn on your TV,"
the deputy CIA director replied.
"I don't have one. Do you have a laptop?"
"I do,"
Harvath answered, as he opened Hermann's backup and pressed the spacebar to wake it from sleep mode.
"What's going on?"
"The White House has just been attacked."
Chapter 40. Harvath didn't want to believe her, but he knew Ryan wasn't kidding.
"Tell me what happened,"
he said, as he opened the computer's browser and surfed to one of the cable news sites.
"Suicide bomber,"
the CIA deputy director replied. "She leapt the fence on Pennsylvania Avenue and..."
"Wait,"
he interrupted.
"She? It was a female bomber?"
"Yes. She got all the way across the north lawn and detonated on the driveway, just outside the north portico."
"How the hell did she get that far?"
"Somebody screwed up," Ryan admitted.
"You're damn right somebody screwed up. Anyone hurt?"
"So far, there are 3 fatalities. All uniform Secret Service. They were moving in to take her down when she clacked off. We can't even estimate the number of injured yet."
"God damn it,"
Harvath replied. He had been recruited to the Secret Service from the SEALs. He had worked presidential protection.
"Was the president there? Is he all right?"
"He was in the West Wing when it happened. They evacuated him to the bunker. He wasn't harmed. They're deciding whether to remain in place or move him to the COG facility."
COG stood for Continuity of Government. The facility Ryan was referring to was a secure fallback location for the president during times of attack or national emergency.
"How long ago did this happen?"
he asked.
5 minutes.
Harvath could now see a live feed streaming from Washington. Hermann, Farber, and Bosch gathered around him.
"Mein Gott!"
Hermann exclaimed. They stared, stunned, as the camera panned across the charred, iconic facade of the White House.
"That's not all," Ryan added. "Seconds before she got to the driveway and detonated, she unfurled a long black banner.
Let me guess, with white Arabic writing on it?"
"Yep. Never slowed down for a second, just kept running."
Harvath took a breath.
Have you confirmed this is an ISIS attack? Publicly? No. Internally? Absolutely. Do you think this is connected to our guy?
He asked.
Pitchfork? The deputy director replied. We don't know. But you can add this to your list of questions to ask his handler.
So, it's still a go?
100%. It's even more important now. Do whatever you need to do. Understood?
Understood,
Harvath replied, as Lydia Ryan disconnected the call. Harvath knew it was a serious, maybe even deadly mistake to let his anger get the best of him. Nevertheless, he fumed. ISIS had struck inside Washington, and now even more Americans were dead. They had hit one of the greatest symbols of the United States. It was a target they had been threatening and lusting after for years. Now they had actually done it. Harvath's anger was tinged with shock. They were getting exponentially better. Each attack was more dramatic than the last. He didn't have the proof yet, but he knew the Russians were involved with this one too. First Turkey, and now D.C. Harvath didn't want to think about what might be next. It was all the more reason to grab Sergun and get him talking ASAP. The attack in D.C., though, made Harvath doubt his plan. Every TV in Berlin, actually every TV in the world, was filled with the images of what had happened at the White House. Everyone was aware of it now. That didn't mean that terrorists around the world would take the night off, but a public kidnapping of a Russian military attaché in Germany would not come off as a coincidence. It would get hyped even more than if it had happened just by itself. The media thrived on fear. He could hear it now. First Antalya, then D.C., now Berlin. What political target will the terrorists strike next? Harvath was beginning to think that perhaps the entire plan should be scrapped. Instead, just slip into Sergun's apartment, grab him in the dark, and carry him out. Screw the witnesses. Let the Russians think whatever they wanted. It wouldn't make any difference. Sergun would be gone. Harvath discussed it with Hermann.
What do you think?
The man shrugged. It's your operation.
That's not an answer.
You're right.
Harvath waited, but his friend didn't say anything further.
If we snatch him from his apartment, the Russians are going to suspect Germany was behind it.
Hermann shrugged again. Not my problem.
Harvath had seen this attitude growing across Europe. So many people struck him as unhappy with the way things were going, and while some were pushing for massive changes to straighten things out, others had completely given up, resigning themselves to the idea that their nation's best days were in the past. Harvath refused to ever allow himself to think like that. As long as you could fight, you were in the fight, and that meant the fight wasn't over. Nothing was impossible. To a certain degree, it was easier for him to feel that way. America wasn't Germany. It wasn't Europe either. Despite the tragic blows the United States had suffered, things were different. How long they would remain that way was the question. With each attack, there was a call for more security. What had happened at the White House was going to shake Americans to the core. Harvath knew President Porter, though. His instinct wouldn't be to batten down the hatches, at least not at the expense of people's individual freedom. He would want to reassure the American people to bolster their self-confidence and instill in them a sense of control over their own lives. Government wasn't the answer, and he wouldn't pretend it was. Even so, there would be a call for the president to do something. That was how people reacted to situations that frightened them. Something must be done. Doing something was a panacea. It didn't matter if the most popular thing being proposed wouldn't have stopped the attack in the first place. Many would still demand that it be done. Do something. Anything. It was all about people feeling safer. Harvath was reminded of a quote attributed to Ben Franklin. Those who would trade a little liberty for a little added security deserve neither and will lose both. Maybe the president would be able to reassure America, maybe not. What Harvath did know was that if they didn't get to the bottom of these attacks and stop another one from happening, the clamor to do something would only get louder. and what they would call for being done would be even more dramatic. Too many people had died. Too much had already been lost. Enough was enough. Harvath looked at Hermann. He had made up his mind. Chapter 41. Friday evening. When Victor Sergun entered his apartment, the first thing he noticed was that his electricity wasn't working.
Old East German building, he thought to himself. Old wiring.
He was Russian. He was used to things not working. He made his way to the kitchen. The electrical box was in the pantry. So was his flashlight. There was another in the bedroom, but he didn't feel like walking through the dark to retrieve it. He knew the apartment well enough to navigate into the kitchen without one. It was like all the other cheap apartments his government had placed him in around the world. He couldn't really complain, though. He had lived in places much worse. At least he was in Europe. Laying his coat over the back of the lone chair at the breakfast table, he crossed over to the pantry. Hopefully it was just a fuse. He had a small box of spares sitting on one of the shelves. He opened the door of the pantry and pop! Sergun heard the sound at the same time he saw the red light of a laser pointed right at his chest. That was the last thing he remembered before the searing hot pain shot through his entire body. The taser still in his hand, Harvath sprang from the pantry as Sergun's body hit the kitchen floor. He didn't bother to remove the barbed metal probes from the man's chest. There wasn't time. Rolling him onto his stomach, he placed plastic easy cuff restraints over the Russian's wrists and yanked them tight. He then did the same with his ankles. He finished by tearing off a piece of duct tape from the roll in his coat pocket and placing it over the military attaché's mouth. Looking up, he nodded. Hermann began radioing commands to his team as he laid out a black plastic body bag in the hallway. It had been punctured with air holes so that Sergun would still be able to breathe. As they bent down to pick him up, he began to struggle. Harvath waved Hermann back and depressed the trigger of the taser again. The painful burst of electricity raced through the Russian's body like shards of broken glass, and he went completely rigid. When the pulse ended, they rolled him over and picked him up. Harvath had his shoulders and Hermann his feet. They carried him into the hall and laid him on top of the unzipped body bag. Harvath patted him down, going through his pockets, around his waistband, the seams of his trousers, everywhere. Russian intelligence officers were notorious for the escape and evasion materials they hid on their persons. In addition to his passport, credit cards, and a roll of cash, Harvath found a handcuff shim, a small razor blade, and a length of diamond-encrusted string that could be used to saw through restraints. Once those items were removed, he and Hermann half-mummified the man with duct tape. The less he was able to move, the better. When he was sufficiently immobilized, Hermann let his men know that they were ready to roll. Zipping up the body bag, they waited for a knock on the apartment door. Seconds later, there was a soft rap. Hermann let Bosch and Farber in. Everyone grabbed a handle, and they exited the apartment, closing the door behind them. They moved quickly to the stairs and headed down the three floors to the street. As soon as they stepped outside, Adler rolled up in Hermann's BMW and popped the trunk. Harvath looked up and down the sidewalk. There was no one in sight. Nodding, he gave the order to move. They threaded the space between two parked cars and threw Sergun in the trunk. Hermann then shut the lid and climbed in back with Harvath and Farber. Bosch jumped into the front passenger seat and Adler drove off. The entire operation had taken less than 10 minutes.